century. Love in the 21st Century is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Mary's Gone Crackers, manufacturers award-winning gluten-free and certified organic vegan crackers, pretzels, and cookies at their own dedicated gluten-free facility in Gridley, California. Their products are allergy-friendly and can be found in grocery and health food stores throughout the United States and Canada. More information at marysgonecrackers.com or 888-258-1250. Oh, I was supposed to play. Oh, at 5:30.
All right. You did the disclaimer.
Oh. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters. This is 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond.
Grabs her magazines, she packs her things and she goes. She leaves the pictures hanging on the wall. She burns all her notes, but she knows she's been held to a few years. Feel this old. He smokes his cigarette. He stays outside till it's gone. If anybody ever had a heart, well, I wouldn't be alone. Knows. She's been here too few years to be gone. Every old Wednesday, let it be good to go away someday. Yeah, but if there's nothing there to make things change, if it's the same. Just hang. Trouble understand if she got reasons he don't. Until she grabbed up her coat and she goes. She's been here too few years to take it all in stride. Yeah, I was still, it's much too long to let her go.
Okay, we are back on the air here in Love of the 21st Century. It's been a while for me. I am Desiree Susan, and I'm here with Tamara as well as Guillermo here in the studio. And today I'm going to be talking about a topic near and dear to my heart, love and as it applies to mental health. The last song here was a very personal song for me, actually, as it was some, it was a song that I had in my playlist in high school, and that was the first time I ever had addressed my own mental health issues. So basically, I wanted to start out by talking a little bit about statistics that I had found on mental health, and it was kind of eye-opening to me because I realized how many people in this country and county actually have mental health issues. And they're saying that 1 in 5 Americans have mental health issues at any given time in the year, and 1 in 25 have severe mental health issues, and that 40% of people never get treated for their mental health, and that there's on average of 50. Back in 2012, I was able to find there were 50 suicides in just in Butte County alone in 1 year, which to me was a lot more than I had thought. And having recently had a friend commit suicide, I have been sitting with that and really wanting to actually start talking about it more because I feel like it's important. And that last song that I played by Matchbox 20 was a song that I had discovered after actually having tried to commit suicide myself. And that is something that I'm actually wanting to talk about and bring to the forefront of people's minds, is that more people that you know are suffering, and to talk about it, because I feel like the more that it's talked about, the less stigma is around it, and the more that people don't feel alone. And I think that loneliness and not talking about it actually just makes it fester and build up inside and makes it cause more problems for them or you. And I feel like it's a really important thing to engage in, because I feel like if you talk about the hard things, they kind of lose their strength, and they also create more of a bond with you and your loved ones. So that's one thing. And I was going to bring up some TED Talks that I had found and some different approaches to healing, and also talk about how love and loving relationships can help heal mental illness. So, Tamara, is there anything you wanted to say first? Or
No, I'm really excited to be here in a different seat tonight. I'm sitting facing the control panel versus being behind it, so that's exciting.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
Yeah, exciting to see you there taking the lead. That's fantastic. And I would agree, this is mental health is a topic that is often brushed to the side or not wanted to be talked about. People want to avoid it or pretend like it doesn't exist. We just want to highlight all the good stuff. We recently had a pizza party, and we were talking about sort of the Facebook phenomenon that is like, everything's great and life is amazing, and look at how wonderful my job is and what great my friends are.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, minus I was just screaming and crying before I made this post. You know, because I mean, that's obviously a dramatic explanation, but the reality is that we have this positive Facebook outlook on life, that we only want to look at the positive side of things instead of the more challenging stuff. And then the reality is that it's through those challenges that we actually become stronger and healthier people.
Right.
And so,
Yeah.
So it's good to bring this to the forefront of conversation, because it doesn't have to be something that we're scared of. And when I was listening to you talk about those statistics, that 40% of people that have mental health issues never get treatment, like, that is astounding.
Mm-hmm.
That is an astounding percentage of people that are suffering that are not going to seek medical help, whether that's medical or alternative help or counseling or talking to friends. And the main reason I would, you know, go out on a limb and say, it's because of stigma. is because of how harshly we judge people for not having their stuff together, not being able to handle all the pressure. And, like, let's just be real. Like, that is ridiculous. Like, there's no reason why any of us should be putting up with as much stress as we do in our lives.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting that you bring that up, because one, the first part about Facebook, I feel like, is something that goes along with something I've been told a lot, is that nobody wants to be around somebody who's sad or depressed or has anxiety. Everybody wants to be around somebody who's happy and fun. And I grew up with that stigma of not being told not to cry, you know, not to feel things and not to show emotions that are negative. And I feel like that's what people do post on Facebook, is you know, based on somebody, just knowing somebody from Facebook, one, you'll never know fully the full, like, usually won't know much of what's going on. Two, I feel like Facebook has also kind of made people feel like they're more social than they really are. Right. They feel like they know what people are doing and know what their, you know, how their life is, and they feel like they're hanging out with them because of that. Right. Whereas we used to hang out with people more.
Yeah.
And so I feel like that actually contributes to that false engagement. So you're not really engaging with people. So that kind of creates a dynamic of loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and as we know, like the first, like I was talking to Guillermo earlier about this, one of the first things that most people do when they get depressed is lose energy and desire to want to hang out with people or exercise or get up and do things. Mm-hmm. And so that just adds to it, is this like feeling of seeing everyone else's lives being good in their mind. Mm-hmm. And then they're feeling like, oh, I'm feeling so sad. And to me, I've experienced this myself, where it almost makes me feel sadder that I don't know that I feel alone. Like, oh man, I'm having anxiety. I'm having panic. I don't know what to do. And then I read Facebook and it's like, oh, I just got a puppy and a new job and I'm in Tahiti. Oh, great.
Now I feel even better. Yeah.
And now I feel really alone.
Totally.
And that is where I felt at the worst part of my depression and feeling suicidal, was feeling alone and feeling like I was the only one in the world. I feel the importance of talking about it, because mm-hmm. I feel like the more that you talk about it, the more you realize you're not alone in this.
Right.
The more I've come to see that people have struggled and, you know, and it's interesting too that you talk about the stigma of getting mental help, because I have gone that direction and gotten mm-hmm. the westernized medicine in treatment type help. And I found it, and I've recently experienced a coworker's own personal experience with this. And I have to say that I feel like there needs to be a lot of transformation going on in the mental health facilities, because I don't feel like there's enough help out there for people.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, a lot of people go in there and there's not enough help for them to even go. Like, say you're struggling and you really are at that level of being suicidal, there's not even enough beds for people to go in and get the help they need right now.
Right. Well, I think that there's a great discrepancy in terms of the amount of help and what help is available and what people actually need. I think that there needs to be more preventative alternative care than the extreme life-threatening situations. I don't think we should be waiting until people are so disconnected from themselves and from their communities that the only place left for them to go is a lockdown facility for their own good. Like what you were saying before, Desiree, the symptoms and the behaviors are far before that, when people start to isolate and they start to lose interest and they don't want to be around anybody. And we as a society, as a community, as United States, lack of culture, we don't know how to deal with that. We let people just go deeper and deeper into their holes and deeper into their vortexes of negativity, and we don't even ask, you know, what's going on. And if we do ask what's going on, it's kind of like in this judgmental, get it together, everybody else is doing it kind of way. And so I think that we need to start far back beyond where we are starting with people, and realize that as family, as close friends, as partners, we have the greatest influence over those people's lives. And that's just the reality of what it is. And we can all pretend like that's not the truth and like it's all up to the individual, which I definitely agree. Like, people that end up in, you know, horrendous situations, obviously it was their last choice. But mm-hmm. we as close loved ones need to really look at those signs and take people seriously when they're asking for help, you know, or you see them acting strangely or oddly or acting out of character, or giving away their stuff or losing interest in wanting to hang out and not going out and, or, you know, getting really into drugs and alcohol. You know, be there and be willing to be there to the point where you, maybe you're not going places because you're with this person so much. Like, I had a friend that was in a similar situation, and some of my friends wanted to take them to the Puff. And I was like, man, I've been to that place to do an internship there. I was like, I cannot send my friend there. I know that, like, that is the place that you send people when they're having psychotic episodes. But I, from experience in working in that place, like, it's not always the best place for people, because it's if you're in a, like, highly psychotic place, you need to be de-escalated. You need to be supported. You need to be told that you are loved. And so with this friend in particular, when he was staying at my house, I'm like, every 5 to 15 minutes, my partner and I were telling him how much we loved him every time. Like, we love you, we love you, we love you. And I mean, we did that for weeks until he sort of came back to earth, and it took a while. Mm-hmm. And my friends and my roommates that were living with me at the time weren't too jazzed on the fact of that, but that's what showing up for somebody that's like really going through it, I think, takes is mm-hmm. being so present that you allow it to kind of maybe interrupt.
Yeah.
Your day.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you from my experience, I have actually, and I will say that no matter what you need to do for yourself, mm-hmm. Whatever you need to do is what you need to do. Mm-hmm. But for me, and I feel like a lot of people are going in this direction, the medications actually numbed the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt like a walking zombie having been on antidepressants and I wasn't ever on antipsychotics, but anxiety medications. Mm-hmm. And they actually made me feel worse. And I have recently discovered in the last few years the use of amino acids. Mm-hmm, yeah. And I wanted to bring up that fact is that mm-hmm. there are so many alternatives to the westernized medicine that you can do. So if you are someone out there who's listening and might be struggling and don't have insurance or proper insurance or don't even want to handle going into a doctor, there are many of things you can do outside of that world that can make you feel so much better. And that book, The Mood Cure, mm-hmm. is something that I highly encourage people to read and take the quiz on. There's actually a quiz online mm-hmm. On themoodcure.com. Right. And there is a practicing psychiatrist here in town. Her name is eluding me at the moment, but she practices and sends clients into my work that use amino acids, such as GABA, the 5-HTP, L-theanine, ashwagandha, mm-hmm. L-tyrosine. And it's very interesting to me because I actually feel at my best on the certain amino acids. Within hours,
right.
you can actually feel better if you are deficient in an amino acid. Right. It's astounding to me.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting about the Mood Cure, because I've listened to some of her talks, uh-huh. is that, you know, a large percentage of community of people living in the United States are actually deficient in amino acids. And so when they were doing these studies to see if amino acids would have an effect on people's mental health, they had gotten the research from a doctor, I believe, at maybe at Stanford? No. No, it was a medical school. And he had done research on drug rehab patients. And so basically got the people off drugs. They were still like super into eating all this like trash food. And so their moods were still like, really low. And so they're like, okay, let's try to, the nutritional direction. And so they started mm-hmm. giving them better foods to eat. And their moods increased, but they still had intense cravings for these other foods. And so they're like... So he thought, what about amino acids, which are the building blocks of everything in your body, your brain and your muscles? And so they started giving them to the patients, and they found that they remarkably started doing much better. Yeah. And then, so this woman, the doctor who wrote the mood cure, she wanted to test the same theory to see if it applied to people with mental health issues that didn't have drug addiction issues. And she performed this very similar study. And did they not only see that it bettered the lives of the people they were studying, they started giving all of the, you know, the journalists and the documenters and the data analysts the amino acids too. And every single person had a marked improvement in their functioning. Every person, whether they were like seriously deficient or slightly deficient. And so what that tells you is that there's such a great need for our bodies to have these amino acids. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that our functioning or our absorption of the amino acids in our foods is so low. The foods that we eat are very low in like the nutrients that we need to function. Mm-hmm. And even if, when you're deficient, it's like when you're sick. When you're sick and you need some vitamin C, you don't need just a little bit of vitamin C. You need a lot of vitamin C before your body gets back up to that functioning level, and then you don't need it as much. And so when we're talking about deficiencies with amino acids, like, we all could probably use, I started taking those amino acids like probably like 6 months or so, and yeah, it's the silliest thing, but I took those amino acids and I swear the next day I could remember things so much easier. It was, yeah. I was like, there's no way that it's because of these amino acids. But it was like, I was able to, I would like remember where my keys were. I know this is a silly thing, but I would remember where I placed things like so quick. Yeah. It was amazing. And yeah, I couldn't speak more highly of the idea of just trying it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. For me, I mean, even what I found interesting was like, my mom has always told me that I'm like a slow bloomer, like, what you call me, late to thrive kind of person. And not that I'm not remarkably intelligent, it's just that I, due to like such trauma, I believe, in my early childhood, that I had a deficiency in L-tyrosine. Like, I had lower motivation to like really apply myself. And I have recently been completely opposite. Like, I'm like, oh, let's do this, let's do that. I've been on the L-tyrosine for a while now, and I find my motivation, my energy, my everything to be so much better. And
yes,
I mean, my sleep is better with the, I mean, I take a few different ones, but like everything just is right. Remarkable. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you know, she does talk about it. She talks about how everything from food cravings to energy levels to your brain health. And the other person that I wanted to talk about, and in terms of mental health, is what's her name? Oh, the GAPS diet. GAPS diet's another thing I wanted to mention in terms of something people can do without having to go into a doctor or do anything. The GAPS diet is a book you can do, and it's also obviously a diet that you can do with a lot of bone broth and soup and gut healing, because she was able to find that gut health and mental health correlated so much between, you know, she was a psychiatrist who found that her patients often had gut dysbiosis, which means that you have a lot of gut bacteria in there that are not good for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of people, she was able to correlate like schizophrenia, even bipolar, anxiety, all kinds of different things to gut health. And when they healed the gut, a lot of them improved or completely got rid of their mental health issues.
Absolutely. And that's another thing they talk about in the mood cure, is that there is not, in her opinion, there's no such thing as like hereditary mental illness, that mm-hmm. it's actually hereditary nutrient deficiencies, which makes a lot more sense to my mind, that people in their family, they share the same deficiencies. So when it's one, the parent is deficient in these certain minerals, so they have the symptoms of bipolar. Of course, their children are also going to be deficient in these nutrients because their genes are passed down. And right. So then their same symptoms are going to be displayed as being bipolar. And so I just felt like it was such a more logical way to look at it, like, oh, like what's the strange thing that these cells are doing that creates these symptoms? No, like, what are these cells not getting to perform at their optimal best? And that's basically what her research has shown. So it's really, I think, such fruitful information to look into, especially if you yourself have mental health needs or someone close to you in your family has them.
Oh, and also I wanted to remind people, if you're listening out there and you wanted to call in, 895-0131 is, no?
That's the office. No, oh. That's the studio number. That will get you in the studio. 895-1114.
Oh, there you go.
We'll get you directly on the air.
Thank you. So, yeah, please call in if you have any questions or comments about mental health. Or
yeah, something to share. 895-1114. Yeah, I want to echo what you were saying before, Desiree, with, you know, whatever it takes to take care of yourself is the number one thing. And so as we're sharing these alternative ideas, just realizing that wherever you're at and whatever it takes, whatever you allow yourself to do to get the help that you need is good, is great. Like, you and yourself is worthy in this life and needed, and you add so much. Every one of you that's listening, everyone that's in this community, everyone that's in this world, we're here for a reason. And so if you're feeling, you know, struggling, and like your medications are the best thing that are helping you, then like more power to you by every means. It's just once you are in maybe in a more stable place, or maybe you want to sustain staying on those medications, whatever it is in your best interest, we're just offering other creative ideas to look at the world from.
Yeah, especially since that there's less, I feel like people are feeling less of a stigma around going into a health food store maybe than a doctor's office. That creates anxiety for me. I don't know. Probably a lot of people. Like having to talk about it to someone. Whereas you can walk into a health food store and go, oh, where's your mood stuff?
Definitely.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's great.
And also, you know, sometimes there's a lot of side effects around some of the medications, and that's just from my personal experience. I've never felt better, honestly, taking different approaches to mental health. And actually, you know, I feel like my relationships have improved ever since I've been willing to open myself up and tell people or be there for them during their hard times too.
Right.
You know, and also there was an interesting thing you brought up about being there for your loved ones and talking about mental health that I found. It was a psychiatry advisor article that I found that talks about the positive effects of love on mental health. And I've been talking to my boyfriend a lot lately about how I feel like I feel better. Before I met him, I actually, you know, I still have days where I have anxiety or a low mood or things like that. But I have felt, and something has changed within me as far as feeling more stable and secure and having a partner that I trust and love and feel safe with. Mm-hmm. And today, I actually found this article which kind of explains some of that, I think. And it talks about love, the deep feeling of affection to the embodiment of virtues that always protects, trusts, hopes, and perseveres. And they're saying that now a better understanding of the biology and chemistry of love and science has begun to recognize that there are health benefits as well, helping our patients understand the value and importance of maintaining loving relationships may help them benefit from love's positive mental effects on mental health. Love is more than just an isolated feeling. Science now provides us evidence that what is experienced when we are involved in loving relationships involve various neurotransmitters and hormones in our body that affect us systematically. In the book, General Theory of Love, a trio of psychiatry professors describe it as nervous systems are not separated or self-contained. Beginning in earliest childhood, the areas of our brain identified as the limbic system are affected by those closest to us, and synchronizes with them in a way that has profound implications for personality and lifelong emotional health. Interestingly, we can actually see evidence of these connections when we explore research in the area related to stress management, depression, and anxiety. The ability to adequately cope with stress management is a protective factor against mental illness. Let's see. Depression and anxiety disorders are the most common mental health disorders in the United States, and social isolation, which you were talking about earlier, is clearly linked to higher rates of depression and anxiety. According to Health and Services report, getting married and staying married reduces depression in both women and men, and research in the areas of physical health has also shown that high levels of social support may actually improve prognosis in terms of conditions such as cancer, myocardial infarctions, by reducing symptoms of anxiety and depression that can be often associated with these illnesses. Accordingly, treatment of depression oftentimes includes focusing on interpersonal relationships as a way to improve depression, as in the case in attachment therapy in children and interpersonal therapy in adults. Emotionally focused therapy, which focuses on transforming relationships into ones that feel safe, secure, and connected, have also been found to be effective in significantly reducing the symptoms of depression and anxiety. I found this to be interesting because I feel like that speaks to volumes to creating a real dynamic and dialogue in your friendships and relationships, and how that can improve your mental health and your loved one's mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that to be an interesting article in terms of this show and love. And,
yeah.
You know, I feel like a lot of people have this like stigma around like, you know, oh, I don't want to date somebody who's quote unquote crazy or be right around people when I'm feeling down. But it turns out it's probably the best thing to do is to just
right
be around someone and engage in it and be willing to be vulnerable and talk about it.
Right. Yeah. If you can be in that, if you can be relating in a healthy way, that's definitely, I feel like, an important part of it. But it's when you were mentioning before around like the labels of like schizophrenia and bipolar and depression, that's one of the stickiest parts I have with mental health, is the labels that people are tagged with, and then they start to really personify those things as though that is really who they are. And I really don't think that that is an okay thing. I don't think that people are the labels. And I mean, I've spent some time reading the DSM, and I remember when I was studying it back when I was in school, and I remember reading the like four characteristics of schizophrenia and getting a little like, you know, twinge in my gut as I was like, I could identify with some of these things.
Yeah,
and I remember saying that to my professor, and she said, well, yeah, of course, they're all normal things. It's only when they're exacerbated to the point of your functioning do they become a mental health issue. And so, yeah, I think we have such a disassociation in this culture. Like, once we give something a label, it's like, oh, I don't understand what that is. What's schizophrenia? It's like, well, what is schizophrenia? It's like delusional thoughts. It's paranoia. It's, you know, thinking that something is working against you in your favor. I mean, a lot of those are three out of the four things that describe schizophrenia. And I think a lot of people could identify with those things on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
They think somebody is like out to get them. Like, they think their boss doesn't like them. They don't think their friends don't like them. They don't think their partner, you know, there's all these stories we tell ourselves. And so I just think it's really important that we kind of back away from the labels a bit. Like, and I think give people some space to, you know, identify the way that they want to identify with that. And also realize that just because there's a label, that doesn't mean any one of us really has any idea what that means, because none of us are medical professionals. And so we're taking, like, if someone said they had lymphoma,
yeah,
I wouldn't pretend to know what lymphoma is because I'm not a doctor. But
yeah,
like, apparently when someone says I'm schizophrenic, we're like, oh, we know, you're crazy.
Yeah.
That's all I need to know. You know?
I don't want anything to do with you.
I don't want anything to do with you, but like...
Let me just walk around out yeah. there. But it's interesting. It's real interesting. Now, this is something that I can remember vividly in my experiences of being in a group therapy session. Mm-hmm. This girl was talking to me about how she was schizophrenic and she didn't understand why she was in the hospital because she didn't feel like she had done anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And her landlord was scared of her. Mm-hmm. And so she was called in to mental health by her landlord, and she couldn't understand why she was in there. She didn't feel like she had done anything. And she began to talk to me about schizophrenia and how she didn't feel schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. She was told she was schizophrenic. She didn't feel schizophrenic. Mm-hmm. And she thought it was unfair that people could take drugs to hallucinate mm-hmm. and be legal, or not legal, but seen as being cool out in our world. But she saw things or heard things and it wasn't okay. Like mm-hmm. it was like really interesting to me, you know,
right?
People choose to like take psychedelics. That is okay to be like, right. See things or hear things that aren't there. But and then as soon as it's not something that people see as a party thing, then it's like there's a stigma attached to it.
Right.
And I could see where she was coming from with that one.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I think it goes back to like a cultural perspective though too, because if you look at different indigenous ways or people in different cultures and how they view mental illness, it's not the same way that we do. We have a very disconnected, distorted view of people with mental illness. It's not like mental health issues are a new thing. And again, we call them issues. We see them as a problem versus like maybe what information might be coming through those people, which is traditionally how it was seen. People
yeah,
that were,
yeah,
they were
spirits.
They were spirits, right. And they were considered to be more sensitive to other dimensions. And so mm-hmm. that's what they were being seen in that and or being affected by. And so there was more of a spiritual response to it versus a medical response, which I mean, I think most people that work in the mental health field or with individuals that are in the mental health field realize that it doesn't really work. It doesn't really work. Even the medications or whatever have you has a lot of side effects and isn't actually helping the person to be more connected in society and function better. It's making it easier for everyone else that's around.
Yeah.
And that's really what the medications in the yeah. mental health field is about, is dissipating the symptoms so that they, not necessarily can function better in society, but so that their symptoms don't bother other people.
Yeah.
And that's the unfortunate reality.
Okay, we have to take a break here and play the Will Durst.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with a few choice words about President Donald Trump's unique yeah. personal style, which can best be described as which lumbering and oafish. He's as graceful as a pile of crumbling cement blocks. Yes, our new chief executive is a blundering tank whose apparent goal is to antagonize the rest of the planet. Not just the other nations of the world, but Mother Earth herself. First, the real estate developer went to a NATO meeting and scolded its members. Then demonstrated how to put America first by shoving the Prime Minister of Montenegro out of the way so he could rush to the front of a photo shoot. After coming home, he was responsible for a midnight tweet that ended with the words, "Press Cov Feffi." Either he was rhapsodizing about making coffee with a French press or spelled coverage wrong. He probably realized his mistake and tried to delete and correct the spelling, but his tiny little fingers betrayed him, and he ended up hitting send. We've all done it. Most of us would have deleted the tweet and started over. But President Orange Canopy not only left it up, he pretended he meant to say it, because he is incapable of admitting a mistake. Ever. Not even a misspelled word. He's 12. Simply put, he tried to mess with us. The President of the United States tried to mess with the country over a typo. Then he messed with the planet by announcing he was pulling America out of the Paris Climate Accord, obviously following through on his promise to make America Jurassic again. Some liberals fear this is part of a long-term GOP plan to encourage global warming so rising ocean waters flood California coastline cities and the state's electoral votes turn reliably red. But maybe when the president said that he doesn't want other countries laughing at us anymore, what he really meant is he's ready to step down. Fingers crossed. For KZFR Radio, I'm Will Durst.
Oh, we are back here on Love in the 21st Century, and I'm Desiree Susan, and I'm going to be playing a video from TED Talks by Thomas Insull here. It's called Toward a New Understanding of Mental Illness.
So let's start with some good news, and the good news has to do with what do we know based on biomedical research that actually has changed the outcomes for many very serious diseases. Let's start with leukemia, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, ALL, most common cancer of children. When I was a student, the mortality rate was about 95%. Today, some 25, 30 years later, we're talking about a mortality rate that's reduced by 85%, 6,000 children each year who would have previously died of this disease are cured. But if you want the really big numbers, look at these numbers for heart disease. Heart disease used to be the biggest killer, particularly for men in their 40s. Today, we've seen a 63% reduction in mortality from heart disease. Remarkably, 1.1 million deaths averted every year. AIDS, incredibly, has just been named in the past month a chronic disease, meaning that a 20-year-old who becomes infected with HIV is expected not to live weeks, months, or a couple of years, as we said only a decade ago, but is thought to live decades, probably to die in his 60s or 70s from other causes altogether. These are just remarkable changes in the outlook for some of the biggest killers. And one in particular that you probably wouldn't know about, stroke, which has been, along with heart disease, one of the biggest killers in this country, is a disease in which now we know that if you can get people into the emergency room within 3 hours of the onset, some 30% of them will be able to leave the hospital without any disability whatsoever. Remarkable stories, good news stories, all of which boil down to understanding something about the diseases that has allowed us to detect early and intervene early. Early detection, early intervention, that's the story for these successes. Unfortunately, the news is not all good. Let's talk about one other story, which has to do with suicide. Now, this is, of course, not a disease per se. It's a condition, or it's a situation that leads to mortality. What you may not realize is just how prevalent it is. There are 38,000 suicides each year in the United States. That means one about every 15 minutes. Third most common cause of death amongst people between the ages of 15 and 25. It's kind of an extraordinary story when you realize that this is twice as common as homicide and actually more common as a source of death than traffic fatalities in this country. Now, when we talk about suicide, there is also a medical contribution here because 90% of suicides are related to a mental illness. Depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, anorexia, borderline personality. There's a long list of disorders that contribute. And as I mentioned before, often early in life. But it's not just the mortality from these disorders. It's also morbidity. If you look at disability, as measured by the World Health Organization, with something they call the disability-adjusted life years. It's kind of a metric that nobody would think of except an economist, except it's one way of trying to capture what is lost in terms of disability from medical causes. And as you can see, virtually 30% of all disability from all medical causes can be attributed to mental disorders, neuropsychiatric syndromes. You're probably thinking that doesn't make any sense. I mean, cancer seems far more serious. Heart disease seems far more serious. But you can see actually they're further down this list, and that's because we're talking here about disability. What drives the disability for these disorders like schizophrenia and bipolar and depression. Why are they number one here? Well, there are probably three reasons. One is that they're highly prevalent. About one in five people will suffer from one of these disorders in the course of their lifetime. The second, of course, is that for some people, these become truly disabling, and it's about 4 to 5%, perhaps 1 in 20. But what really drives these numbers, this high morbidity, and to some extent the high mortality, is the fact that these start very early in life. 50% will have onset by age 14, 75% by age 24. A picture that is very different than what one would see if you're talking about cancer or heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, most of the major illnesses that we think about as being sources of morbidity and mortality. These are indeed the chronic disorders of young people. Now, I started by telling you that there were some good news stories. This is obviously not one of them. This is the part of it that is perhaps most difficult, and in a sense, this is a kind of confession for me. My job is to actually make sure that we make progress on all of these disorders. I work for the federal government. Actually, I work for you. You pay my salary. And maybe at this point, when you know what I do or maybe what I've failed to do, you'll think that I probably ought to be fired. And I could certainly understand that. But what I want to suggest, and the reason I'm here, is to tell you that I think we're about to be in a very different world as we think about these illnesses. What I've been talking to you about so far is mental disorders, diseases of the mind. That's actually becoming a rather unpopular term these days, and people feel that for whatever reason it's politically better to use the term behavioral disorders and to talk about these as disorders of behavior. Fair enough, they are disorders of behavior and they are disorders of the mind. But what I want to suggest to you is that both of those terms, which have been in play for a century or more, are actually now impediments to progress. That what we need conceptually to make progress here is to rethink these disorders as brain disorders. Now, for some of you, you're going to say, oh my goodness, here we go again. We're going to hear about a biochemical imbalance, or we're going to hear about drugs, or we're going to hear about some very simplistic notion that will take our subjective experience and turn it into molecules or maybe into some sort of very flat or unidimensional understanding of what it is to have depression or schizophrenia. When we talk about the brain, it is anything but unidimensional or simplistic or reductionistic. It depends, of course, on what scale or what scope you want to think about, but this is an organ of surreal complexity. And we are just beginning to understand how to even study it, whether you're thinking about the 100 billion neurons that are in the cortex or the 100 trillion synapses that make up all the connections. We have just begun to try to figure out how do we take this very complex machine that does extraordinary kinds of information processing and use our own minds to understand this very complex brain that supports it, supports our own minds. It's actually a kind of cruel trick of evolution that we simply don't have a brain that seems to be wired well enough to understand itself. In a sense, it actually makes you feel that when you're in the safe zone of studying behavior or cognition, something you can observe, that in a way feels more simplistic and reductionistic than trying to engage this very complex, mysterious organ that we're beginning to try to understand. Now, already in the case of the brain disorders that I've been talking to you about, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, well, we don't have an in-depth understanding of how they are abnormally processed or what the brain is doing in these illnesses. We have been able to already identify some of the connectional differences or some of the ways in which the circuitry is different for people who have these disorders. We call this the human connectome, and you can think about the connectome sort of as the wiring diagram of the brain. You'll hear more about this in a few minutes. The important piece here is that as you begin to look at people who have these disorders, the one in five of us who struggle in some way, you find that there's a lot of variation in the way that the brain is wired, but there are some predictable patterns. And those patterns are risk factors for developing one of these disorders. It's a little different than the way we think about brain disorders like Huntington's or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's disease, where you have a bombed out part of your cortex. Here we're talking about traffic jams, or sometimes detours, or sometimes problems with just the way that things are connected and the way that the brain functions. You could, if you want, compare this to, on the one hand, a myocardial infarction, a heart attack, where you have dead tissue in the heart, versus an arrhythmia, where the organ simply isn't functioning because of the communication problems within it. Either one would kill you, and only one of them will you find a major lesion. As we think about this, maybe it's better to actually go a little deeper into one particular disorder, and that would be schizophrenia. Because I think that's a good case for helping to understand why thinking of this as a brain disorder matters. These are scans from Judy Rappaport and her colleagues at the National Institute of Mental Health, in which they studied children with very early onset schizophrenia. And you can see already in the top, there's areas that are red or orange, yellow, are places where there's less gray matter. And as they followed them over 5 years, comparing them to age-matched controls, you can see that particularly in areas like the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex or the superior temporal gyrus, there's a profound loss of gray matter. And it's important, if you try to model this, you can think about normal development as a loss of cortical mass, loss of cortical gray matter. And what's happening in schizophrenia is that you overshoot that mark. And at some point when you overshoot, you cross a threshold. And it's that threshold where we say, this is a person who has this disease, because they have the behavioral symptoms of hallucinations and delusions. That's something we can observe. But look at this closely, and you can see that actually they've crossed a different threshold. They've crossed a brain threshold much earlier, that perhaps not at age 22 or 20, but even by age 15 or 16, you can begin to see the trajectory for development is quite different at the level of the brain, not at the level of behavior. Why does this matter? Well, first, because for brain disorders, behavior is the last thing to change. We know that for Alzheimer's, for Parkinson's, for Huntington's, there are changes in the brain a decade or more before you see the first signs of a behavioral change. The tools that we have now allow us to detect these brain changes much earlier, long before the symptoms emerge. But most important, go back to where we started. The good news stories in medicine are early detection, early intervention. If we waited until the heart attack, we would be sacrificing 1.1 million lives every year in this country to heart disease. That is precisely what we do today when we decide that everybody with one of these brain disorders, brain circuit disorders, has a behavioral disorder. We wait until the behavior becomes manifest. That's not early detection. That's not early intervention. Now, to be clear, we're not quite ready to do this. We don't have all the facts. We don't actually even know what the tools will be, nor what to precisely look for in every case to be able to get there before the behavior emerges as different. But this tells us how we need to think about it and where we need to go. Are we going to be there soon? I think that this is something that will happen over the course of the next few years, but I'd like to finish with a quote about trying to predict how this will happen by somebody who's thought a lot about changes in concepts and changes in technology. We always overestimate the change that will occur in the next 2 years and underestimate the change that will occur in the next 10. Bill Gates. Thanks very much.
Okay. Well, we are back here on Love of the 21st Century just for a few more minutes, and we'd like to end this by just saying a few final words and listening to a song by Brett Dennen called Ain't No Reason. Thank you for listening. I feel like this is a really important topic, and hopefully you've gained some insights and information and are feeling inspired to jump in to taking care of your mental health more and or your loved ones. Let me turn your mic on there.
Yes, practice taking care of yourself. May we all practice taking better care of ourselves so that we can show up in the best way possible for not only others, but most importantly for ourselves. How much more amazing life can become when we take that little extra time to love ourselves. So if you're feeling the need, if you're feeling the call to talk to somebody, to do some research on Google, to go see Desiree at the
New Earth Market.
New Earth Market.
Yes,
in
please.
The
health and supplements. Well,
health and supplements area.
Yeah.
Then do it.
Yes.
Then do it. We
I would
are
gladly
here.
Help you.
Yes, fantastic. Thank you so much, Desiree, for this show.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you for being here. So I guess what my final words are just that I feel like the more that you're willing to open up and show up and have courage to pay attention to your mental health, the more life can improve and your relationships can improve. And I know it can be a scary, scary place to open up at first, but from my own experience, I've felt that it's just vastly improved my life by having the vulnerability there and being able to share myself with others in a deeper way.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to play you a song, and then they're going to be coming in to do
Ecotopia.
And thank you again for listening, and tune in next week from 5 to 6 with Adam.
Brian Anthony.
Mm-hmm.
Way is how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day. Preachers on the podium speaking of saints, prophets on the sidewalk begging for change, old ladies laughing from the fire escape cursing my name. I got a basket full of lemons and they all taste the same. A window in a pigeon with a broken wing. You can spend your whole life working for something just to have it taken away. People walk around pushing back their debts, wearing paychecks like necklaces and bracelets, talking about nothing, not thinking about death. Every little heartbeat, every little breath. People walk a tightrope on a razor's edge, carrying their hurt and hatred and weapons. It could be a bomb or a bullet or a pen or a thought or a word or a sentence. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I don't know why I say the things I say, but I say them anyway. The love will come, set me free. Love will come, set me free. I do believe. Love will come, set me free. I know it will. Love will come, set me free. Yes. Prison walls still standing tall. Some things never change at all. Keep on building prisons, gonna fill them all. Keep on building bombs, gonna drop them all. The wind blows wild and I may move, but politicians lie and I am not fool. You don't need no razor nor a three-piece suit to argue the truth. The air on my skin and the world under my toes. Slavery stitched to the fabric of my clothes. Chaos and commotion wherever I go. Love I try to follow. Love will come set me free. Love will come set me free. I do believe. Love will come set me free. I know it will. Love will come set me free. Yes. There ain't no reason things are this way. It's how they always been and they intend to stay. I can't explain why we live this way. We do it every day.
This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento River, the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next is Ecotopia. We'll be talking about bicycles built for one, for two, and even for 20.